the special meeting of the Unalaska City Council is called to order 6:00 PM on Wednesday, August 12th, 2016. Ask Councilman Ungo to read our mission statement.
Provide the sustainable quality of life through stewardship of government.
City Clerk, may I have a roll call, please?
Mr. Bell?
Here.
Ms. Coleman? Mr. Longo? Ms. Louie?
Here.
Mr. Chastain?
Here.
Mr. Tungo?
Here.
Mr. Tudikoff?
Here. Do we have a quorum? If the other two will show up. Please join us in the pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Thank you all. I have a motion and a second to adopt the agenda.
Move to adopt the agenda.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Tungo, second by Councilman Chastain. Are there any objections? Hearing no objection, the agenda is adopted. Next is our work session. May I have a motion and a second to go into a work session?
I make a motion to go into work session.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Louie, second by Councilman Chastain. Hearing no objections, we are in work session at 6:01, 6:02, I guess. We are in the work session. First item is the comprehensive plan discussion. Erin Olson, Yaley AICP Senior Planner, R&amp;M Consultants. I'll turn this over to the city manager for introduction.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. It has been a long day, haven't it, Mayor? I'm going to turn it over to Cameron Dean so he can introduce our consultant, Taryn, who's joining us remotely, so we can talk about her work so far on comprehensive plan.
Sure. So Taryn is one of the consultants we've been working with from R&amp;M on the comprehensive plan updates for the last year. She's been running all of our community engagement for this project, and she'll be facilitating this work session. So I'll turn it over to her.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Cameron. Hello, everyone. Are you able to hear me okay?
Not so much. We'll change our speaker out. Yes. Mm-hmm. We'll switch our audio because that is the maximum that it's set up. Just a second, please.
No problem. While you do that, I will share my screen and make sure we've got that working.
That got considerably better.
Yes.
Oh, great.
But I may need to come in with this one to charge you. So maybe if we switch to that.
Well, we could hear her now.
We still need the mic, though, on the owl.
Oh, okay. Because my battery is low, and this one's not charging enough.
Okay, Taryn, I'd say go ahead and we'll work on the clerk's charging issue separately.
Okay. If at any point you need me to repeat or speak up a little louder, I will do my best on my end as well. All right. Thank you all for holding a special work session. We're really here to have a discussion about the comprehensive plan, and we're moving towards drafting recommendations. We're working on our land use plan and taking accumulation of what we've heard over the past year from our working group, our advisory committee that we've assembled, as well as the focus groups that we hosted back in February when we had a big public engagement effort in person with the community. And taking what we heard and trying to turn those into actionable recommendations to help guide not only this body, but staff's decisions, and hopefully also be a tool for our nonprofit community and just members of the public to help advance and create a better quality of life in Unalaska. So like Cameron said, I'm Taryn Olson-Yell. I'm the lead planner on the project from R&M, but by no means am I doing this effort alone. First and foremost, this is as much Cameron's plan and his team's as it is anything that we're working on the consultant side. And I'm supported by McKinley Research Group, who is leading all of the economic analysis components of this plan, as well as Alta Planning and Design, who specializes in transit studies and non-motorized transportation. So we're here to talk about the comprehensive plan. And as many of you know, and as I believe Cameron briefed you all on ahead of this meeting, the comprehensive plan is our mid to long range decision-making tool for future actions, plans, and policies. We're talking about a 10-year timeline. Unalaska seems a little unique. You guys like to update your comprehensive plans a little bit quicker than other communities, which I think is a wonderful thing. It makes sure that the policies in here are, one, current, two, that you're more flexible in making changes to make sure that we're being responsive to opportunities as they arise, and also you're able to make recommendations that are really truly more actionable because you have a slightly shorter timeline. So it's exciting to be working on more of a 10-year, maybe up to 15-year horizon. The comprehensive plan is the document that defines our long-range goals, but it also, again, outlines those specific actionable strategies. And the thing we really want to focus on today is actionable strategies as it relates to land use and development in the community. So things that rely on a comprehensive plan, why is it important that we're updating this plan overall? Like I said, land use changes. So when people decide that they want to maybe develop vacant land that they own or repurpose what they're doing, or even the continuation of something that they're doing with their property, the comprehensive plan should help support that decision-making process. It's the document that your community development team is going to look at and reference anytime people bring conditional use applications before them. It should also be helping guide any rezones or code revisions throughout the community, and can also and should also support capital improvement and any infrastructure investments that the City Council is choosing to make. So just a quick overview of what we've been up to since we initiated the project. We are kind of in this phase three, like I said, recommendations, implementation strategies. We've moved from the what component of our investigation, so identifying kind of who we are, what we as a community really value right now, and what challenges you're all working through. We've distilled that down into a draft vision, and we have guiding principles and goals that we've defined through our public engagement process. And now we're getting into the what and the how. How do we start working to achieve these goals? How do we make these guiding principles something that are reflected throughout all of the actions that we're going to be taking? We have a goal of getting an adopted document done by spring of next year. And so from this point forward, we're really going to be going into plan drafting mode. And we're excited to be having this conversation with you all today to, like I said, really dig into recommendations and make sure that what we are going to start drafting is accurate and supported by council. I do want to highlight that we have two special focuses for this comprehensive plan update that are a bit different from the last one, and that is a transit component, so looking at potential transit opportunities, as well as putting a pretty heavy focus on economic analysis. So this is where Alta and McKinley Research Group have really been essential to our project team, and we have an economic analysis memo that we very recently finalized that will be an appendix to the comprehensive plan, and is informing a lot of our description about existing conditions and recommendations. There was also a transit study that was conducted. Hopefully some of you took the survey that went out last year regarding that. The transit feasibility study is written as a standalone document, but our intent is to really take that study and fold it into recommendations. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that. Can you all hear me all right? There is some work being done outside my window all of a sudden, so I want to make sure that you can still hear me. Yeah. Okay, I saw. Perfect. So we conducted a transit feasibility study to try to understand the need, the viability, and what options there might be for expanding and providing any transit within city limits. And so this looked at considering costs and benefits, potential ridership forecasts, and to compare possible ownership structures. The results of this survey that we conducted were pretty promising. We had over 150 community members participate. Almost all of them were full-time residents, and ended up with a result that over 50% of participants said they were at least somewhat likely to participate and use transit services if they were available. The destinations that they reported on weren't really that surprising for us as a project team. They're the areas that we figured most people would want to go, either to passively recreate, to go to work, to make sure that they're getting to school, and then your major attractions like the PRC Center, Dutch Harbor Mall, Grand Aleutian, and the Visitor Center. Most people reported that they would again use it for shopping or errands, commuting, as well as recreation, so getting around to see their friends and meet up in the community. There were four different transit models, service models, that are compared in the feasibility analysis, and those are the fixed route service with paratransit, which would be a requirement if the city were to provide a fixed route service. What we call a deviated fixed route, which is really similar, except there's a little more flexibility, so we'd like to call it a flexible service route. Traditional demand response, I think the easiest way to explain that is somebody requests a ride from wherever they are to a specific location, and someone calls and fills that role. And then there's the microtransit, which is kind of a combination between a demand response and a deviated fixed route. So in our analysis, we ended up recommending a phased approach to transit, and we think that this might work for Unalaska if there's interest in pursuing it. And that would be to start with a microtransit model. So microtransit is really a technology-enabled demand response operation that's within a set service area. So this is where you have kind of like your Uber and Lyft experience, where you would request a ride, and you don't have to do it a whole day in advance. You can do it in real time. And you have set drivers, kind of like Uber and Lyft, who would be the ones responding to that. But then there's route limitations on where they can go. And so there is dynamic response there. It's on demand, but also is still a little more controlled, and typically rides are grouped. So in a microtransit option, you'd be kind of doing like a van pool situation.
Sure.
Yeah,
once we get, yeah, are there any questions?
Yeah, how does that differ from a taxi service?
It's a good question. Taxi service, they might have limitations on where they travel to, but they also might not. And that's usually going to be limited to a single rider. In the microtransit option, they're going to try to group riders together. So instead of, you know, if you were to call a cab right now, they might be down the road in 5 minutes. Microtransit, you might need a little bit more lead time, depending on how that service is set up. So they might say, we're going to run this route in half an hour, and we're going to pick up two or three other people along the way. Really good question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Move on.
So there's going to be discussion within the comprehensive plan, kind of summarizing the results of that feasibility study. They are there for, like I said, informational purposes, and maybe including some recommendations if there is appetite for that as we continue through this process and get feedback at the draft stage. The next thing I want to review with you all are the guiding principles and goals that have come out of our process so far. So we had some questions in that transit survey that also related to the comprehensive plan at large. Those helped inform the development of these guiding principles and goals. We looked at the last comprehensive plan for quite a bit of inspiration on that, and went down the list and said what is still relevant and should be carried forward. And then lastly, we worked with the advisory committee that we have to really develop the first round of these principles and goals. These were presented at the public open houses that we had back in February as part of our Futures Conference for feedback. And we got a lot of really great feedback and suggestions that we continued to workshop with the advisory group during that time. And we have landed here. I'm not going to go through and read all of these, but they're here in case we have questions about it as we continue our discussion. But I do want to draw your attention to the items in blue. And so the bullets that you see that have blue text are ones that we feel are most directly applicable to a land use planning component of the comprehensive plan. So these are the things that we're keeping in mind when we are making decisions about potential changes in land use, making recommendations for land use categories. What does that mean for how we might change our land use code or our zoning code? These are those things where we would come back and say, does it support this item in blue? Some or all or a combination of. So these items include things like vulnerability to natural hazards and extreme weather events. This relates to land use because we don't want to make a recommendation for an essential service in an area that might be really prone to landslides or flooding or within a tsunami inundation zone. Investing in improvements to homes and infrastructure and taking pride in our built environment. This is something that we heard a lot of back in February, and it's really just that you as a community want to continue to improve what we have here and really be able to take pride in it once again. The ability to improve and expand homes and infrastructure is absolutely a land use planning exercise, and so that's something that we want to prioritize. Encouraging the integration of permanent residents and seasonal workers throughout the community. This was a really great discussion that came up across multiple focus groups, and it really highlighted that there is a bit of a divide in the community between people who maybe live in certain neighborhoods and live and work full time in Unalaska, and the folks who are coming to really be part mostly of the seafood processing world and maybe live and work all within a processing facility or rarely get off the boat. And so the ability to encourage those folks who may just be here seasonally or associate with that processor to come out and enjoy all the wonderful things that make your community so unique and great.
Hey, Taryn.
Yeah.
Just so you know, we're going to switch over the mic to another computer, so there might be a little pickup in the audio.
Okay.
This should just take a moment.
No worries. And please feel free to cut me off at any point. I have a hard time seeing the room.
Can she hear us right now?
The mic is off.
Turn off my mic.
And then you're on the room audio?
Can she hear us now?
Can you hear us, Taryn?
I can, and it looks like I'm hearing you from Cameron's computer, potentially.
Hey, Taryn, this is Zach. Thank you for going through those blue blue highlights you mentioned earlier. On our screen here, it's difficult to tell the difference between a blue and a black writing.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I will keep reading them through then. That's really helpful. Is the text too small?
Too small.
Yeah.
Get bigger would help. Yeah.
I can zoom in. Okay.
Can you change?
Oh, that's better.
There you go.
Okay.
Our eyes to this one.
Do we feel good about the audio change? I can hear you.
We can hear you well as well.
Okay. If that changes or I'm going too fast, please feel free to flag me down at any point. I also lost your visual, which is okay. Just please cut me off if someone has a question or wants to chime in at any point.
Thank you.
You're on. improving and expanding public safety infrastructure. That was a conversation that also came up in multiple focus groups about the ability to make sure that we're providing public services, especially our emergency response, to a level that's satisfactory for the community, and that, you know, is up for debate, but improvements are always better. And to do that, we may need to be expanding that public safety infrastructure. Under the principle of a diverse and stable and sustainable economy, related to land use, we're really talking about maintaining and enhancing the diversity of businesses, services, and job opportunities. I know that this is something that comes up quite often in Alaska, is how do we diversify? How do we plan long-term for stability in our economy when so much of what we're doing is dependent on the fishing industry? And so that is something that we're considering. And as that relates to land use, it's making sure that, you know, do we have enough available opportunity for people to physically develop the types of businesses and services that they want to? What also I think is interesting under this diverse, stable economy conversation, we had quite a few goals that relate to leveraging existing resources. So that would include our ports, looking at the city's role as a regional hub, and really coordinating the public and the private sectors to achieve more in our community. How can we continue to partner in an important way? And one of those was specifically childcare. That came up across multiple conversations as well. And while a little less direct to the land use conversation, it is something to think about when we're talking about what services do people need? What are we planning for? I know healthcare is always top of mind as well, but including that education and childcare component in our thought process is important as well. Under our principle of a community that values its culture, education, arts, and history, we have a goal to support the development of public spaces that promote community gatherings and cultural events. Absolutely a land use component. Where are we going to provide those public spaces, and what kind of public spaces do we need to continue to support? Does support mean invest in what we have, or does it mean we need something new? All questions to be asking as we go through this conversation. Okay, I'm gonna zoom in again. It's a little easier to read. A couple more blue texts I just wanna highlight before we dive into a land use conversation. One of the principles is a resilient community that collaborates and stewards its natural environment. And when we talk about development, that's very, very applicable. We want to make sure that we're promoting development practices that consider our environmental impacts and apply sustainable design principles where we can. Related to the previous principle, at the very first one we discussed, is considering things like tsunami inundation zones and vulnerable areas, places that could be at risk. And we especially want to consider that when we are discussing or considering investing in public facilities. You know, we don't want to be making investments that might be in an overly risky location. We also want to make sure that we're considering the preservation and enhancement of natural resources and maintaining and enhancing opportunities to access the natural environment. Opportunities to access could look like a lot of different things. Just some context into the conversations we had with the public. There was quite a bit of desire to establish more wayfinding or the opportunity to promote recreation out in the natural environment in the community. And that applies to both like kind of soft surface when you're thinking like hiking or backpacking trails or mountain biking opportunities, but it also really applied to the more built on-road network for the non-motorized user. So people who are walking and biking in the community. We talked a lot about the need for sidewalks or extended pathways or improved ways for people to get around without a car. We have a principle where we want a connected community. The connected community applies to a lot of different things, including that city's non-motorized transportation network that I just described. It also includes this very clear upfront, promote and integrate an approach to land use and transportation planning. So that's making sure that if we are making a recommendation for development and land use in a certain area, that there's proper connectivity to go out to it. And are the roads and the sidewalks going to support the amount of use we expect that development or land use to get? So maybe you're thinking about it in terms of not new land use, but existing. Do the places where most people live have sufficient connectivity that is safe? Do we need to be making improvements to any intersections to make sure that people are able to cross safely where they're safely crossing or where they are actively crossing? This principle is also expanding to things like the airport, which we know is an important ongoing topic. And it also applies to amenities that are supporting people who are traveling, whether for residents or maybe for tourists as well. And then lastly, we have a principle that we are a community that fosters sustainable, responsible growth and development. This includes encouraging responsible land use that supports the economic, environmental, and social character of the community and expands the availability and affordability of housing options. We're going to dive into housing quite a bit today, so I hope you guys are excited to talk about housing, because as a planning nerd, I am. Cameron, is there anything you would like to add about where we're at with kind of our goals and guiding principles and how we're, are there any important ones maybe that I missed that you want to bring up before we continue?
No, I think you brought up the ones that are relevant to this conversation. I just reiterate that, you know, these have come, like, we didn't make these up. They've come out of multiple public engagement events and talking to people, and we distilled down a lot of input that we received into just these bullet points.
Great. Okay. I'm going to ask a question. Who's looked at the land use plan that exists currently in the comprehensive plan? I can see you all now. So if you have looked at it, please raise your hand. Cameron, your hand should go up. I know you have.
Yeah.
Okay. No other hands in the room. That's okay. It's Cameron's job to really be looking at it and using it to make decisions. So in the existing comprehensive plan, there is a 2015 land use plan that was developed, obviously, after the last comp plan was adopted. And it does a very good job of categorizing what's on the ground right now. So that's the map that you're looking at on the right. This is one that shows today's conditions, what land is being used for. So things that are in that deep purple are industrial storage, classified as that's their land use category. And these categories are intended to be specific enough to give you information to tell you what's happening, but also aren't so specific that it is intended to be limiting. So the 2015 plan is like, here's what we have right now, this big package of categories. The 2015 plan makes general recommendations on a neighborhood or sub-area level for where we might see change, not where, for what types of changes we might see. So in the 2015 plan, it might say in the Mackinac retail area, they want to see an increase in commercial use and a decrease in, I can't even remember off the top of my head, a decrease in open space, for example. But it didn't go so far as to say exactly where or which parcels that would apply to. It made very general goals. And so our mission with this comprehensive plan update is to develop a land use plan that takes it to that next step and tells you not just what, but where. So when we started that discussion and we really delved into these land use categories, we came to the conclusion that there were a lot of them, too many of them, and they were potentially too prescriptive to go in the direction of making these more where type of recommendations. And so what we recommended and have workshopped with our advisory group is to develop these proposed future land use designations that are intended to be slightly more general than the categories that describe what's there now. And we want to apply what we're going to describe as a soft edge approach. So instead of saying this exact parcel that's red is going to change to something else, we're talking more like a blurred edge around it to try to generally help landowners and the community understand the direction of development that we want to go. So trying to thread the needle between being helpful in making land use decisions and recommendations, but again, not being so prescriptive that we are completely eliminating somebody's opportunity to do what they want with their property.
Could you give an example? I'm sorry, could you give an example of some of those? Of the ones that you're proposing?
Yeah, we don't have the maps developed yet. We wanted to, well, we workshopped a little bit with the advisory group what changes we might want to see. And right now that looks like kind of sticky notes on some of these existing land use category maps. I will work on pulling that up on my screen while I talk. But I think maybe another example too is this transition from the categories to the land use designations. So in the land use categories, we have this single family or duplex residential. We also have a mobile home residential and a multifamily. So there's kind of three levels of residential that's being described. Our future land use designations have changed that to two. So we're recommending a low to medium density residential, which could include that single family and that mobile home residential, or a medium to high density residential, which could be multifamily, but could also include maybe some new densities that we could consider, like smaller lot sizes with maybe a triplex or a fourplex on it, which could fall into multifamily or a medium density residential.
So like a duplex, for example, would fall in your low and medium, or it would go to medium high if you had more than one unit? I guess that, I'm just trying to differentiate what each one means.
Yeah, yep. I would, the low to medium density residential would include the duplex category.
But if you had a triplex or bigger, it would go to medium high. Is that right? Or could you do the triplex in the medium, low medium, I guess?
I think this is a great question that we would love your feedback on, is kind of what do you all consider a medium density residential? I would recommend that a triplex, even a fourplex, could go into a medium category, which you could find in either of our future land use designations. So that's kind of that sweet spot where maybe you have a larger parcel and you're able to fit a fourplex and it makes sense with the adjacent properties to put in a fourplex. That could be a medium that would fit and be compatible in a low density medium residential, as opposed to, you know, surrounded by single family and someone's proposing a 16 unit apartment complex. I would not consider that as compatible with a low density residential.
Okay, that makes sense. And then, so when I was kind of read through this and I thought there was something about, maybe it's the mixed use commercial, is that residential commercial where somebody could have maybe have a business below and an apartment above. As we all know, housing is hard, and a lot of people, you might employ your employees up above a store or something. And I'm just curious, is that what that, would that fall in under that category?
Yeah, that's actually one of the topics we wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
I'm going to think, yeah, turn to the slide.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's my next slide. Thank you. Perfect question. Perfect segue. Yeah, this is something that we heard quite a bit through our outreach so far. I'm just going to zoom in a little bit just so this is clear for everyone. A couple of things. We heard that housing is hard to come by, and the kind of housing that people want may not always be available, or it's available at a price point that isn't advantageous for them to pursue. They're not able to be in the type of housing that they want to be in long term. We've also heard that commercial development is tricky, whether that is really expensive spaces to lease or it's just really cost prohibitive to start up somewhere new and also pay for somewhere to live. This mixed-use commercial is intended to provide that flexibility and provide a mix of both residential and commercial either side by side so that we could look at areas like downtown. I think that's the biggest point that we've talked about. And with our advisory group, the recommendation was let's make almost all of downtown a mixed-use commercial designation. We want to see more retail and kind of like restaurants or office uses in that area, but also recognize that there's people who live there and should be able to continue to live there. And so that could be, like I said, a combination of land uses side by side, lot by lot, or it could be combined into a single lot or structure. So that could be commercial as a primary use and then having an accessory dwelling unit, either standalone or attached where someone is residing. Yeah, an apartment above or a office within the house, that kind of a situation. So we're looking at existing land use categories would include our current mixed use, the commercial designation, multifamily residential, maybe single family. Curious how you all feel about including single family or a duplex in a mixed use commercial category. That was a lot of talking on my end. I'm very curious, initial thoughts. And maybe talking about it in the context of downtown is easiest. Well,
I've got to work with your neighbors if they're, you know, if you put like a commercial residential on a residential place, mostly residential. And, you know, with put a commercial, you usually take parking lots and other stuff that you gotta consider. If it's a residential, commercial, well.
I think that residential and commercial could be together, especially downtown. I mean, we've lost all the businesses that were downtown, and I hear that a lot from a lot of people. That, you know, it's like there's nothing downtown anymore. You know, and there used to be Ocean Merck and Carl's, and you know, there was other stores and stuff down there, and people don't go down there anymore because there's nothing more. And I think that people would like to see more stuff downtown. I think the less regulations, the better.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the harder you make it for people, you know, the worse it is. So the issues with letting commercial and residential be together, you know?
Yeah, like I think back to like the early to mid 90s on Standard Oil Hill, which is a kind of a very heavily residential area. There were a number of people on Standard Oil Hill who started home businesses and were selling clothes out of their like one side of the duplex would be a shop, and the other side of the duplex would be a single family dwelling. And it was really successful, allowed those kind of that kind of nuance and the life of the community to be there. And then that went away over a period of time. And now we really don't have any of those small shops that is, they're just somebody that wants to try to do something great in the community. But I think where that would really come into play, at least potentially, is those small art studios where an artist can create art in their home and sell it as well. And I think that would help develop the culture of the community as well. Because that's one of the things I've seen that's gone away in the last 15 years or so, is really that art scene here. We've lost the Aleutian Arts Council, that's gone. We've lost those events where people come together and they purchase art and promote the culture of the community. So I think this could be a really positive thing.
Well, the downtown area is so traffic-wise, people are parking on other people's lots, and now you got new housing coming in, taking over the place of older houses. And they're not making any provision for parking.
I think it's
that's a problem because you need a fire truck or an ambulance to get in some of these places. It's just not possible to make that fair shot for somebody's house. I deal with it in the hot housing area. By the ball field, two or three people, families are trying to do good, and we get automobiles repaired, turn into a car lot, junkyard, and it affects the people who live there because they have to listen to trucks running 10, 11 o'clock at night, tuning up vehicles, things like that. And I feel for them because, you know, they're doing it. They don't have a job where they can work, a place they could work without having to pay more than what they get for leasing a property and building a place on. A lot of people can't afford it. Way too much. So I don't know about other businesses, depending on where they are.
Yeah.
Should be.
As a type of business.
They're not going to allow access by police, the fire department, the EMTs.
And what kind of latitude? I'm sorry, go ahead, Tom.
I'm thinking out loud here. I mean, the scenario where there's in a residential area, there's a home-based business. I think that's still allowed under, you know, current land use. I'm thinking back to when I was on the planning commission, the conversation that was had once about a light industrial that had resident that wanted to put residential, you know, units above that or as part of that. I don't know, have we run into that type of variance or request or building permit type application in the last 5-10 years? Or
we do get permit requests for doing mixed use occasionally. So like that situation, or say a welding shop that has an apartment over it. What our code allows by right now in a residential area is a home-based occupation, which is sort of it's a home first, and then there's a business there as well. It's pretty limited what kind of business you can operate there. So just in terms of like traffic coming in or noise or even the sign that you put up in front of it. So say if Deneen was starting you're running a bookkeeping business out of your house.
Doing that.
But if you had office there where people are coming and going, you know, probably not getting as many people as you would for like a clothing store. So things like that are typically allowed by right. But right now it wouldn't allow, necessarily what Zach is describing, something like a retail store that has a lot more traffic.
Or pick some cars.
Yeah, or the car. Yeah.
Well, I know people, they do hooking in their house and do delivery. I don't know if they get business license on some of those people, but.
Send me their name.
They pre-cooked meal that they, homemade pre-cooked meal that people do at their house and then ask people, people ask them to cook for them and they from.
So I think the real question then is like that right now people could, following the appropriate DEC code and stuff like that, cook a meal and sell it from their house. What would be prohibited right now would be to have a duplex on Standard Oil of a small clothing store on one side of the duplex and live on the other side of the duplex. What currently would be prohibited now, from what, and I'm correct if I'm wrong, is having a place down on Loop Road or Old Hud Housing, where you're working on cars and you're having it's something like that is currently prohibited. And the question before us now is, where do we find that happy medium? Can we say something along the lines of, are there different classifications of business effectively? Or we could say, okay, we don't want industrial, we don't want somebody working on their car at Old Head Housing. But you know what? If on Standard Oil you have a little shop where you're selling Snicker bars on the other side of the duplex, that would be acceptable. I mean, is there a planning world? Is that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's what this discussion is for, is partly figuring out, those types of questions. And then if there's maybe particular areas of town that we want to encourage or discourage that, like Tarn was talking about, downtown or St. Louisville, if you want to make that a universal thing in town or focus it on particular parts of town.
But we can, we have the latitude to exclude certain types of business, like an auto shop in a residential area.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, okay.
I know you can limit, you can say you can limit the vehicles that they can bring in there, but at the same time, when you're not looking, it can pile up really fast. You know, it bring more vehicles in. If you allow it and limit them to be able to just bring a couple of cars at a time, if they're doing service with them, it might be a good idea, but the only problem in the long run, it's probably going to fund up anyway.
Well, I think what Cameron's saying is we have the latitude to say, no, we don't want you to work on any vehicles commercially on your residential property, but you know what? Having an art studio on the other side of a duplex is okay, where you're through traffic, like the mayor was mentioning. I mean, we're not changing the fire code. We're still saying you need these certain turns and these certain setbacks and all this kind of stuff. We're just saying, hey, if you want to put an art studio in your on the other side of your duplex, you can. Or at least we have a lot of latitude to do that.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what our home occupation code does now. There is, with this mixed use discussion, there is the flip side of it, right? If you have a commercial property and maybe you want to put an apartment above it.
Yeah.
Currently, that's not allowed by right. You would need to come to us and get a special permit for it, go through planning commission for it.
You know, which kind of brings up an interesting thing too, is like, can we go back a couple slides to the philosophy slide? Right there. Yeah, guiding goals and principles. You know, I think this is probably one of the most important documents that's in the comprehensive plan, because each director and each member of the council really should use this as our guiding principles for making decisions, whether it's planning and zoning relating to variances like you just mentioned, or it's public works, establishing policy that really helps promote the community and gives the citizens a resource. I think this is probably one of the most important parts of the comprehensive plan as a guiding principle, because this really should guide us in all of our decision making. And I was just at the beginning of the meeting, I was kind of making fun of the 2020 comprehensive plan, which at first glance, it doesn't appear that the city made progress on much of anything in the 2020 comprehensive plan, although I'm sure there are nuances to it. And I'm wondering if we lost sight of what our guiding principles were. So, I mean, that's kind of a long way of saying if we follow these guiding principles, there's a mechanism in place to allow for those unique situations right now, like a home business where half the duplex is they're selling Snickers bars or whatever, right?
And I do think that also you should, if you have a commercial property, you should be able to have housing there as well. I think it should be mixed both ways. My feeling, you know, we might
at least to some extent.
As long as it's related to that business, like their workers talked about earlier.
I guess that doesn't necessarily
want to start a bed and breakfast place, another bed business, basically.
Yeah, well, no, I was thinking like if you know you had a commercial property and you wanted to put residential housing there to, you know, places to rent out. For example, okay, I'll just use the Norwegian Rat. If I wanted to include housing for my employees there, I probably couldn't right now. But what if I had some empty ones because I didn't have employees and I wanted to rent them out to somebody, temporary construction worker or something, until I had an employee that needed to go in there? You know, so you would want, you know, I'm not saying I'm doing that, but I didn't know that I want to do that. I'm just saying that, but that brought up that when you said that, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Sure.
But
that's not
your turn.
But no, right now.
No, not by right.
Not right
now. You would need a special permit, planning commission approval. So we do that on a case-by-case basis. And we have given a fair number of those permits in town.
So I think hammering down into that a little bit more, I mean, because that's really interesting, right? I mean, that goes directly toward what we've identified for decades as being an issue here, and that's housing for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's already being done. It's being done at Unicy. It's being done at Westwood. It's being done at Alyeska. It's being done at Icicle.
clusters
throughout the entire community, right? And it's been very successful. Those are huge congregate settings. And what you're talking about is probably more realistically what we as a community want to see. What's the downside of doing something like that?
I think the concern, if you're asking me, like, you were raising concerns about this disruption to neighbors in the community, that's kind of always a concern when you're increasing activity places.
Sure. I think you're right. But it kind of makes sense to allow that by right.
I think if you have commercial and you allow housing, that's one thing. Because then they're choosing, you know, it's different, I think, than, like, if you put commercial out in the valley where everybody lives, that might be a little different story, maybe, because it's all residential.
It's like to say, not my backyard.
Yeah.
Pushed into smaller community, smaller lots, smaller roads. But then it's allowed in that area. I think if you're going to do any dramatic changes, you need to look at the whole scope of where housing is at.
Yeah, and maybe certain.
But then there have commercial lots. Loss of businesses in the downtown area is due to commercialized property that have grown, like AC, the Three Bears now. Gas station is closing down up there. Three Bears is closing down.
Yeah.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Down. I don't know if they've gotten been in.
Well, they're going to keep the card lock going, but they got card lock now and credit card, so.
So that's closing down, but I look at it and I said, why? They have high traffic area of anyone, and yet they're closing. Kind of concerned about them, not saying Western or Pacific could start their own little gas station, which they provide fuel anyway to these stores right now. And losing one and having to think about there's only one left, it's going to be a serious issue for traffic in general, in my opinion. Who's going to do it up in the valley? Do they want it in that area? They may have to because they won't get back and forth to get gas. They travel all the way. It's quite a run. Make 3 or 4 trips to use 5 gallons.
I guess back on, like, talking about what Janine was mentioning, though, with that a scenario like putting a couple apartments at the rat, like, hey, I wouldn't be opposed to hearing something more firm on how we could implement something like that. I think that would go really well with what we've been talking about again for decades. And whether that's company housing only or for the owner to have the latitude to lease it out or rent it out to other people.
I feel like if it's commercial, you're not impacting residents as much. If you already have a commercial lot in that area,
right,
you know, that it wouldn't really matter. I think where more of it would matter is if you moved into a residential area to put commercial, then that may need to be more limited, because now if you have a mechanic shop, for example, or big trucks, you know, excavators, that might be an issue of that type of a business in a residential area. Do you see what I'm saying? The difference between the two.
But looking at it, like if you, and I'll just use the red example, I realize that's not the case right now,
right?
Looking at it, like if we were to pass this and say, okay, this kind of mixed use is appropriate for a commercial setting, and you put apartments at the rat, would that then become residential? And then would the nuisance ordinance, which says you have to be quiet after 10 p.m., come into play more heavily? Which means the rat would not be able to put music on, or somebody got too loud. You see what I'm like?
It would be commercial, right?
But the nuisance ordinance doesn't differentiate between the zone. It just says if there's noise after 10 p.m. and it's like all these different things as an example. That could be okay. But you have a nuisance.
Would that affect? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, does that ordinance, that would be something that we would have to change if we mix the two together?
So maybe to answer that, Taryn, it might be a good time to talk about the differences between land use and zoning, like the regulatory mechanisms.
Go for it, Cameron. I'll pull up a comparison between the land use and the zoning code map while you initiate it, unless you want me to take the lead. But.
No, I can start. So the zoning is the regulatory mechanism there, and that's our zoning categories are different from our land use designations. The land use is either what's there, or in case of the plan, what's like an aspirational, what the direction we want to see these neighborhoods grow. But the zoning is getting more specific of the, okay, this is what is allowed here and this is what's not, where those regulations start coming in. So I think, yeah, Taryn's got a comparison.
Yeah, my question on the previous conversation we were having before we moved on here, and it kind of goes into this, because what we'd be looking at would be changing zoning laws in order to allow some of these uses, land uses. I'm pretty liberal in my views on what you should be able to do with the land you purchased, right? As long as it doesn't interfere with someone else's right to use their land. But I guess as part of this conversation, is there, even if we get a little more liberal on our zoning laws, or you know, however we do this, is this moving to fix a problem that exists? Is it a solution to a problem? I guess is where I'm going with that.
To me, it seems like it's a mechanism. To me, it seems like it's not the solution to a problem, but it's part of a solution to a bigger problem, which is limited housing. And by allowing like this mixed use, say a two apartments at the RAT or whatever it's going to be, I think we reduce the burden. And then we talked about like this transit plan, which I'm still not up to speed on completely. I mean, if somebody is end up living in the valley and they would have to take transit to the RAT to work, you're taking away that the need for that transit right there. So, I mean, the idea of having a mixed use commercial, I think, is a mechanism that goes towards solving the problem of housing. It's not the final thing.
Yeah. I don't think. No, and I'd support, you know, that type of mixed use. I mean, that the example of having apartments over the RAT, you rent a place over a bar. I mean,
you know what you're getting,
you know what you're getting, right?
Yeah.
But that's all. That's all I had. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'll just add, as Cameron was saying, the difference between land use and zoning. The future land use designations, so where we're talking about proposing potentially a mixed use commercial, there are multiple zoning districts that could implement that land use designation. So maybe an easier one, because it's something that we already have, is that commercial land use and how we have a general commercial zone. So those are really directly compatible. In our future land use designations that we're proposing, we have combined commercial and commercial storage land use land use categories. So this list on the left, where we have the red commercial and the kind of bright fuchsia commercial storage, those are combined together under a new general commercial designation. Implementing zoning districts of that commercial land designation could include the general commercial zoning district, so the red on the list on the right, but could also include marine-related industrial district, could potentially include developable time lands. There are multiple ways that we could write that new future land use designation that could allow multiple zoning districts to achieve the same purpose. So the land use designation is a bit more broad, and that zoning code, as Cameron said, is the specifics. So we could still, we're not necessarily losing the ability to add specific unique situations or regulations that exist in zoning code. it may just be a way to describe and show the direction that we want to move in a little bit easier. Did that clarify anything or make it more confusing?
That's good info. Thank you.
Okay. So maybe an existing example of this is our industrial properties in town. So if you're marine-related industrial, marine-dependent industrial, those already allow employee housing by right there. And we classify all of those just under an umbrella of industrial company town, if that's what they're being used for. But there's other, you know, there's also industrially zoned areas that don't have like a processing plant there that have employee housing. I don't know if that,
yeah,
that helps.
Yeah. So the question you asked, did you get an answer on that one now?
I'll ask the question as much as made a statement that I suppose he was saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking if you get.
And what are you looking from? What are you looking for from us today? Like just the kind of dialogue that we've had tonight, so you can get some takeaways and put it into a different package, or what do you need from us?
Yeah, I mean, this dialogue, like, this is helpful to understand, like, getting a general sense that, yeah, we should be looking at this mixed-use commercial more with this plan. I think understanding how council feels about some of these ideas is what we're looking at out of this.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the same vein, we're also recommending a future land use designation of mixed-use industrial, which we have a long description here that I'll zoom into, but as Cameron mentioned, the industrial company town is a unique situation that you all have, where we've got processors who are providing kind of comprehensive services right there. So there's people who are living there in apartments, maybe they're doing laundry, or there's a shop right there. It's all encompassed there, but also recognizing that there are people who don't work for the processing facility who may want to go over there. Maybe there's a restaurant that we want to go eat at and you aren't associated with the processing facility. We are recommending kind of this more, again, a little broader brush stroke to the land use description and the recommendation for a mixed use industrial, where you could combine those traditionally industrial services with things that are maybe more applicable to the community at large. So including marine transportation, including kind of that general mixed use. And this might also address some of the, maybe not concerns, but the situation where we have people who don't work for a processor, but are maybe living in processor provided housing or renting an apartment from there. So curious how that feels. Does that feel like it would be a benefit to the community? Does that help in planning purposes? I know that this, again, this is before we get into specifics of any zoning code changes. This is the concept at a land use level.
I like that. I mean, there's people that used to rent from UNICE. They used to rent to the public when they had additional housing. I don't think they do that anymore, but it was affordable housing for single people. A lot of times it's to go rent from them. And, you know, you never know, they might want to do that again. But,
well, it's back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Well. No, they did it.
I remember them being used for emergency for families being affected. And so
they were,
that was like
in the teens. Yeah, 2000 teens when we got back.
Yeah.
They were doing that. And then I think they stopped right around COVID. Is when they stopped renting to the public.
Renting to public.
Yeah, I think my philosophy in general is kind of right along with Tom's with this. Like, I'm not a big, I like the idea of not heavily regulating a lot of the land use in a sense. I also recognize that 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when we really didn't enforce the zoning code, probably closer to 30 or 40 years ago, when we didn't heavily regulate the zoning, which we're not heavily regulating it now, and I appreciate that, when there was really virtually no regulation, didn't have street names or physical addresses or anything like that, it was a different community, and we've come a long way since then. So I guess I'm tempering my opinion based on the philosophy that people should be able to do with what they want with their land and appropriate land use management, which I think is important. That's just a long way of saying, yeah, I agree. I think giving the industrial users the latitude, a little bit more latitude, is probably appropriate.
And I'd also encourage input from staff, you know, planning in particular. You know, you see more of the requests for land use or, you know, can we change the zoning or that type of stuff. Just kind of more of a feel in the community that says, hey, if we had this parcel of land, if it was zoned or if the land we used plan was a little bit different, that would promote more growth in this area. That type of input helps us, as you know, as far as our conversation too.
Absolutely. So.
I think I'll add in general, our consolidation of the existing land use categories into the proposed future designations, by quite literally having fewer of them in our future land use designation map, that should help with that compatibility component where someone wants to do something with their land. There's now multiple land use options within our recommendation that the comprehensive plan would support. So if somebody wanted to rezone a particular parcel to a zoning district that was compatible with one of the 8 designations as opposed to one of the however many there are 13 land use categories, it should hopefully make that rezone a little bit easier with planning and zoning with City Council, because there's more potential to achieve the goals of that land use designation. So I think that's in line with kind of what we were describing too, is wanting to allow people flexibility to do with what they want with their land while still being able to take that overall community approach to grow in the direction that we want to as a whole.
Is the mixed use commercial and the mixed use industrial, is that what we're kind of talking about? Is that putting, being able to have like apartments with the business? Or would that also be like the mixed use industrial? Would be like what we just talked about with the canneries and the plants and stuff, with being able to have a restaurant or housing or.
Yeah, that's what we were trying to describe with and the mixed use industrial.
That's what those two things are. With them. Oh,
yeah.
I was just curious if that's what those designations were intended to be. I think for the public, it would help also to have, if, you know, those were the things that we went for, then a description of what it meant, you know, mm-hmm. what they would be allowed. It would give people a better idea.
Yes. Yeah. And we have proposed descriptions for all of our designations at the moment. I didn't want to overwhelm you guys and send you all of that ahead of time. But we are still proposing to keep the traditional commercial and a traditional, more traditional industrial designation as well. So those are the times where we really have that true storage, and we know we don't want, or it would be incompatible or inappropriate to have a restaurant right next to it, or, you know, multifamily housing right there for health and safety reasons. But yeah, the mixed use commercial and the mixed use industrial are designed to provide that flexibility, whether again that's on a single lot or if it's with lots next to one another.
They're going to change the way they pay their taxes on their property taxes. They're going to change.
That would be separate
question.
Well, I guess want them paying more because they, you know, instead of residential, become residential commercial.
But the mill rate's the mill rate, right?
Yeah, but it's the way it says. Like, for example, this year, the residential the assessed values all went up, but it did not go up on commercial property.
Yeah.
So that could be something that is a consideration, I guess, is if you mix the two, I suppose if you have residential in there and one goes up versus the other, I mean, they're still going to value the building.
Yeah.
You know, but for some reason, the residential has been increasing. And I think it's based on sales, right? It maybe is the comparables they're using. I'm not exactly sure how they determine the assessed values. And there's not a lot of commercial sales, so of businesses. And that may be what determines that. I'm not sure. But.
I mean, that would ultimately be from the zoning classification for the property. So, because again, the land use categories are separate from the zoning. So maybe if someone rezoned their property based on this plan, then
it might affect their taxes.
But it would also.
But that'd be their choice.
Yeah, that would be their choice.
Does the zoning affect the appraisal? Like if we're consolidating all from however 20 different zoning categories down to 10 or whatever it is, how impactful would this zoning be on an appraisal? Because that's what determines what you pay, right? So
we're not proposing consolidating our zoning categories right now. That might be.
I thought that's what that other slide was.
So those are the land use designations. But under any of those land use designations, there's multiple zoning categories, like Taryn was saying, that could, you know, fit with those.
Amendments to zoning code could be a way to implement the land use plan or the comprehensive plan. Those are pretty common recommendations that we might make. So I think a good example is the conversation that we're having generally about allowing maybe a apartment on top of a traditionally commercial or, you know, on the same lot as a commercial property for someone who owns or manages that commercial facility. In planner terms, we might call that an accessory dwelling unit. So where the primary use of that property is still going to be commercial, but we're allowing the secondary or accessory use to be residential. If that's something that's not currently allowed in code, but there is a strong desire in the community and with you all to allow something like that, we could make amendments to the land use and the zoning code to allow a use like that within certain zoning districts. So it's kind of like the land use is the more general guide of what we want to do with that property. The zoning is actually the tool for how that gets regulated and implemented, which may need changes based on where we want to go.
But if the property value did go up because we made that change, it would be going up because the property owner could realize additional revenue by having an accessory dwelling unit. So it'd actually be a positive because they would have more latitude to do with their property as they wanted. And the appraisal, whatever it is, would recognize that if it does go up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. They're going to appraise it on whatever they're...
Because of...
They're...
Yeah. Thanks.
Good.
End up, move on.
Let's do that.
Okay, so I feel like if there's any other comments or thoughts that you have as we continue on about the mixed use designations, please don't be shy, ongoing conversation. We did want to ask for your input on housing density preferences. We kind of started this when we were talking about what is low to medium density residential, what does it mean to be medium or high. I'm curious from you all, you know, maybe before we talk about how much housing, I'm curious to what are the biggest obstacles in general that you've encountered to getting more housing in Onalaska of any kind, whether it's single family, whether it's multifamily. What has been the issue? Because as it's already been brought up a couple times, this has been a topic of conversation in your community for a long time. And it sounds like it really hasn't improved substantially. So I'm curious to know why you think that is.
That cost, bringing it here, I mean, buying the material and then bringing it here.
That's a big part, but availability of land is the other part. Like that's, I think availability of land is the real driver behind the lack of residential housing you see. I mean, really, for the most part, barring a few areas, the bulk of the land that's developed is the only land that can currently be developed with the way things are right now, with OC being the primary property owner. So I think the land is probably our biggest issue. And second to that, definitely, is the cost of bringing stuff out here, building supplies, building equipment.
That sums it up. We've solved it. It's expensive to build. We don't feel like we have the land to do it. Fair.
Yeah.
Are there people who want to develop in town?
So like a decision board, right?
Yeah, there probably are, but you know, just to expand on what you're saying, available land for private ownership, very scarce. What you can find at this point is all land that takes a gob of money to prepare the land.
To develop it.
Expensive to build. Who are you going to have build it unless you're going to, strap on your tool belt and, go to it. And then on top of it, materials, cost to get it here, all those things add up. And, our economic situation the way it is and financing and high interest rates and, it all creates a perfect storm that discourages anyone from trying to develop, residential housing out here.
$300,000 home when it's finished. Probably in the end, cost $1.8 billion. That's just for like what you just talked about. That's one of the reasons I believe that we're having. Problem is, OC is not in the mode of selling it. They'll lease it and lease a fairly good rate for you, but you got to pay the rest, developing water, sewer, city. It passes. Created a stop also. I mean, over the years, you heard Mr. Winteren years ago coming to the council meeting almost every year arguing that a 10-foot easement or a 12-foot or whatever it was, 15-foot for utilities took away the value of that property you just developed. It went right down, in some cases, right down between two units. And that cost, he'd have to develop it that way in order to make it work. And they just threw his hands up in the air and says, well, let the land, whoever bought the property, let them deal with it. Said, trying to help, but it didn't. Made it even an outrageous cost. So I kind of sit with Justine. I'm a shareholder of OC, so I got to say that right off. Anything we can get is good, but some of our own shareholders are in the same boat. They can't do anything, can't build a home. They lease the property and turn around and pay $1 million for a $300,000 home. By the time it's all said and done, it's just not going to happen. A speed for OC, but they are in that mode also. They put in 5 units for probably close to $7 or $8 million by the time it's said and done for all 7. It's just buildable land is also a problem. Build on hillsides now. If you don't have flat ground, most of the flat ground is commercial use. It'll act like Island is undeveloped because of that. because they're not going to put a lot of money into other than parking trailers on them. And you still need that space. Where were you moving to build homes? Side of the hill? Build them on the side of the hill. Storage areas for containers. Anybody wants to deal with that when they go rolling down the hill on 100 miles an hour.
Part of the problem with leased land was banks won't loan to build a house on leased land either. Mm-hmm. So, like, banks won't loan money to build on a leased
land. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they will if you have a long-term lease, like 25, 30-year lease, then that covers their payment schedule.
As long as they own
it.
Yeah. You know, there was talk years ago about the city creating effectively a benefit for the city employees of zero or low interest loans to build housing. And the idea was that that would help keep people and retain people within the city workforce. Is that I mean, that's an idea. Is it something we should act on? I don't know. But I think kind of from what I've seen over the last number of decades is to really tackle the problem of OC releasing land, which I think we all realize probably won't happen. And not that I'm suggesting they have an obligation to by any means, is that we're able to chip away at the smaller things, like setting up a multi-use commercial zoning area where the RAT could build two or three apartments for their staff and potentially lease one of those apartments out, and really kind of chipping away at it in that aspect, as opposed to creating a final solution to the housing problem in Unalaska. I think this dialogue tonight
solved the housing problem in Unalaska with two or three apartments being built by
one
business.
No, you're exactly right. It'll be two or three more people that won't need to join whatever kind of longer housing pool that is going on right now. I mean, if there was a way to open up a bunch of land for development and set up low to no interest loans, yeah, that would be, I mean, that would help out a lot. That would create families here. But I think what we've seen over the decades is that's not, it hasn't panned out.
The other issue for low income housing is that I would say close to 70% of the people that would apply for low income do not qualify because of how much money they make.
Yeah.
It's based on income, mm-hmm. not what job you have or who's your boss or whatever. All based on their income. I know that there's one facility right there where I live, and I look at who's living there, and I go, wow, I don't see any of them being low income. They get over $100,000 or $200,000 a year. How do they qualify? I don't know. I didn't look into it, but that is happening. So really, when you build low-income housing, you're not benefiting the people you built it for. That's my opinion. I hope city or the city would get into developing housing, build a home, go with whatever the rates are. They're outrageous right now for rentals. Building it because I want to help. You're going to pay for that. You charge them rent. And you're going to charge them above. Keep an employee. Is that important? Yeah, it is.
It kind of brings up another point to this, kind of this little subsection of this is like, are we broadly, and I think we should, probably promote housing for both rental units and long-term single-family dwellings. But there's two different approaches, right? Like you have like what the mayor was talking about, where we potentially an opportunity to have people build a single-family dwelling and live here in our community, become part of our community. It's like Tom, you have to need everybody else versus a more temporary housing unit, which would be like an apartment at the RAT, where a cook who's there for 2 to 5 years stays and then moves on. So when it comes to setting policy. I mean, that, again,
yeah, school teachers too that
right.
come and go or anything.
Right.
And they're desperate for housing.
I'm just complaining about housing.
Excellent.
Let's get this
show
moving.
Excellent. Excellent. How far do you start with Kim?
I am curious as well before we kind of move on from the housing discussion. I don't want it to feel like it's so negative. We have options. We have ways to help, at least from a land use perspective. But I'm curious, we heard from the community a range of housing options were really desired and needed. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what types of housing should we be prioritizing? You know, what do we really need to encourage more development of? We heard single family, we heard studio units for individuals who are maybe coming for like a couple of years, a school teacher traveling solo or somebody in between. But also heard more multifamily with multiple bedroom units to continue to facilitate full families moving over. What, in your perspective, is needed in your community?
I mean, to have a robust community, you really need a robust housing options, right? Like, there needs to be the single family houses. There also needs to be rental units available for people that come and go. I mean, if you look at what this community has kind of become over the years, in large part, is people that come here for a few years, then leave. And those would be renters with a number of people also staying for a while and potentially buying house and stuff like that. So I think a balanced approach is what my view is. Leaning toward, I mean, the realities of this community, which is a rental market. And frankly, a lot of times a rental market also can subsidize that single family house.
Yeah, well, and when, you know, we don't have studios or units for single people, that's an, you know, that is a big issue around here. And there's very, very little of that, and we need more of that for singles. You know, you got all the school teachers that end up having to, they're all living together, you know, it's because they can't afford to pay for, you know, the only thing that's available is a 2 or 3 bedroom house, basically the rent. And so they have to share, and it's no fun living with somebody you don't know. You have different living habits, and
it's no fun living with somebody you know.
Can I push that a little bit? Where would you put studio units in your community?
I mean, Cameron's office.
Right. They're just going to live where they work. That's the mixed use.
My personal opinion would be that anywhere that there is residential housing, you should be able to put a studio unit, maybe attach it to your place to rent out, or build multiple an apartment complex that are studios or single bedrooms, or maybe a mix of them, or, you know, tiny houses. There you go. Maybe somewhere you can put multiple tiny houses on your property. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another
it's option. Also like the term William. Cottage cluster.
Make a little, I don't know, a little subdivision of tiny homes. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm with Deneen. Like at first glance, I mean, minimal restrictions I think would probably be appropriate. But again, I'd like to hear more on the negative side of it.
Yeah, there's always a negative to something.
Yeah.
You know, property values for other people, that's something to consider too. You know, if you have a neighbor that, you know, has a home and you come in and put a bunch of tiny houses in there, would that drop their value? Would they maybe be upset about that?
Does that increase traffic?
It could increase traffic. Could bring a lot more single units. You wouldn't have kids probably.
Good example in Skyrim right now, right? You have the triplex up there, isn't there?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Triplex area. Well, I guess that area had other triplexes before they were converted, but this triplex is uniquely different than a lot of the other houses. Values went up or down, I don't know. I think right now at first glance, giving people latitude, I would be good.
Less restricted.
Yeah. I think that's a theme we're hearing tonight.
Well, the only problem, sometimes they're getting off code, start dividing inside their houses and not in code, and they create more problem up here.
Say that again.
Oh, when you do studios on some other houses, unless you build new ones, but if you got existing houses and they start, you know, start addition and dividing inside to have a small...
With multiple people living in a studio.
Yeah, and then they're not up to code anyway when they start doing that. That's the only hard part on those residential places, or commercial residential places, when they start adding up on their property to do a rental.
Then they start having problems.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you have to people living there without, you know, getting inspected a lot of times. Once you get inspected, they start remodeling and adding and dividing so they can get more people in there. Then pretty soon you create an hazard. Yeah. It happens. Standard oil.
Well, if they're doing things properly, they would be getting a building permit. And if it's more than three, don't you have to have a fire suppression? Is that part of the, you have to have a fire permit or something with the building?
Well, the thing is, when they got
the permit, requirements do increase as you have more units.
Triplex and above.
Yeah. Triplex and above.
Yeah. When they got the permit, it's a triplex. And then after the permit is in there, it's just sixplex. Or,
and then they just go in and do it. Well, you're not going to stop that no matter what. I mean, unless
and then
we have
the code is not in there anymore.
But as it relates to zoning and setting policies, having that gearing, like studios are definitely an appropriate area and giving people latitude to build on their property. I think it's important as well. Again, in a very measured manner.
Those one at the Standard Oil were three doors up. They got nice studios. They got built, you know, going inside the Standard Oil where the offices used to be, and they become studio for their
the Alaska ship.
Yeah, for their housing unit.
Yeah.
Three doors, yeah.
Let me pose a question here, and some of you have lived here longer than I have. At some point, zoning in this town was changed. The lot size, the minimum lot size, was decreased. In that time frame, did we see an increase in the stock of housing become available?
So I think we did that around 2010 or so when I was on council for a time frame. I don't know. Have you been around for quite some time?
That's about 10 years before I got here, though. So, I'm not sure off the top of my head that had a significant change on things. That'd actually be interesting to look at our history.
Good point.
Just to kind of get an idea on changes in zoning, changes in, you know, regulations and how they affect. That one just kind of popped in my head as potentially an example of whether that had a positive or negative effect on the whole.
That's all.
I'm curious what you all might think about defining those housing density thresholds. So in our future land use designation, we're recommending two residential categories, a low medium and a medium high. What does medium mean to you all?
I guess in what context? Meaning, like, are we talking about a single family dwelling? Are we talking about a three triplex, fourplex, eightplex?
That's the question I'm curious in your thoughts on. because low we would typically consider as a single to duplex. Medium can be a range and high can be a range. The way that your zoning code, and Cameron can speak to this a little bit more, but there's a moderate density residential and a high density residential. In the land use categories as they exist right now, multifamily is anything that's three and above. So we're proposing, you know, kind of like what is that range? What would we consider low, medium, and what would be considered medium high? Does it start at four units? Does it start at three? Should we increase that to be six?
I mean, at first blank, if right now we're saying that two families in one unit is low, potentially expanding that to three families in one, like one, a triplex, effectively, I think would be considered low. I'm happy to share that. Four, yeah, I'm good with four.
Low, medium.
Yeah, low, medium.
What is medium right now?
So for our zoning, moderate density residential is up to four units if the lot is big enough.
Moderate.
Yeah.
So that's basically what you're saying. Yeah, right. That's
yeah.
Yeah, I mean that seems reasonable.
Low, medium would be up to four, and then it would be medium high.
So effectively get rid of low and just go with medium. Is that what?
Or low and high, right? If you go like you're saying you got three now and you want to go to two. Land use. Right?
Yeah, pretty much. So what we're, and again, there can be multiple zoning districts that implement a land use designation. So what you could do is in your low to mid density residential land use designation, we could allow the single family duplex and the moderate density residential in that low to medium land use designation. So both zoning districts could implement and be compatible with the land use recommendation. In the same vein, we have the medium and high density residential land use designation, where you could say that moderate density and your high density residential zoning districts could both fit in that medium high density residential. I guess maybe the question is your moderate density zoning, which is three units, right, Cameron? Three units was the threshold?
Up to four.
Up to four. Up to four.
I don't use it a lot, yeah.
Is so up is to there four a acceptable in the low density designation?
Is there a drawback to just having one? I mean, what are the issues with having a single family duplex and an apartment building right next to each other? What?
So you're saying just treat it as one residential,
one residential area?
I think one consideration with it would be the what Tara was saying at the beginning. So the transportation connectivity and utilities and everything, that once we start getting into those higher densities, there's bigger needs for the roads getting better, utility infrastructure, all of that, that we might want to make that more specific areas with, you know, with that connectivity in mind when we're doing that. And then the considerations people were bringing up earlier, like traffic, noise, all of that. Like, do people in a single, like, if you're buying a single family home, do you want to be next to a large apartment building? I think that's,
no, actually, I should ask that's you. A good yeah. question. Yeah, would you, you know, would you want that? And I don't know if you would have known. So where I was going with that is if you have a lot big enough to, it's cheaper to have maybe six studios in one building if your lot's big enough, or you could have probably two or three single room or two rooms, you know what I mean? So it's cheaper to build one unit than it is multiple, but I guess what would be the problem of having a single family duplex right next to an apartment. That's what are the drawbacks to having those? But you just said maybe you buy a single family lot and you don't want an apartment building next.
Isn't a lot of that mitigated during the permitting process, though? I mean, you're not foregoing the fire code or whatever other applicable code there is. I believe part of the permitting is also ensuring there's parking available for the tenants, that the utilities can accommodate it, all that kind of stuff. So,
oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of that could get mitigated through the permitting process as opposed to being a bar to increasing the capacity for zoning, right? I mean, that's a real question. Like, so like parking would be an issue. If you had a fourplex next to a single family home, parking could be an issue.
But you would still have
the only way you could permit the fourplex is to have appropriate parking.
Yeah, so like the zoning categories have parking minimums that are intended to ensure that there's ample off-street parking for however many people living there. To give you maybe a related example from our current zoning code, if you have a commercial property, the setbacks are different for you if it's next to a residential property versus being next to another commercial property. Like you have a bigger setback if you're next to somebody's home.
How feasible is it to build something? That like kind of what we're talking about. If you were to put a fourplex under current zoning with a fourplex next to a single family dwelling and then take it to the next level of creating one zoning district or whatever it's called, for that, how difficult is it to meld those two and give you the flexibility as person permitting that to say, okay, well, you're at a fourplex, so you need these are your requirements. Or,
you have permitting requirements,
yeah.
You know, fire and electrical utilities, everything, you know, but the land use, so that if you were the owner and you wanted to, you know, build single fam or, you know, studios or one bedrooms, and you could put more in one lot than you could if you had two or three bedroom apartments, right? Because they're smaller. So, but you're being limited to the number of units you can have if you have the designations like we do now, right?
So you're describing like a
gradient.
Defining it based on the size of the lot, like how many units we think you can could build there.
Versus saying, oh, you know, I have this huge lot, but I can only put this little place in there because I can't have multi-units, right? Or I have to build this big house for a single person, or, you know what I mean? That's what I guess I'm just wondering if there was some way to designate not so much each unit versus maybe the size of the lot, and you could put whatever. There's not that many big lots around that could really, well, maybe there are.
I mean, I think the one concern I would raise with something like that is that, say we have a dead end road that has some really big lots on the end of it. It might not necessarily be a good idea to put a really high density unit at the end of that road, farthest away from everything, where all the traffic is going to be going down this road from the end of it. It might make more sense to encourage that higher density closer to the intersection, closer to a major road. So it's consideration I would.
That makes sense.
Raise with that.
You know, it cuts the traffic down in a residential home.
If you're just looking for like kind of broad, like this is where we're leaning, I think if there was one takeaway I have from the discussion we've had tonight, is we want a much more liberal approach to where we're going with this. Meaning we're talking about expanding the low density to something a little bit more. We've talked about opening up some different other options as well related to how people use their land. If there's one takeaway, it's really the direction that I'm hearing is we want something that's open and promotes building, whether it's a residential unit or a rental unit. That's my takeaway.
Just going to make a comment, you know, the idea of for example, a fourplex in a residential area, is since we have those examples, is maybe look at those and say, and work backwards from that and say, that was a good idea to put that there, or it wasn't a good idea. Maybe that needed to have a larger lot that it was on, or,
yeah.
You know, other considerations, you know, we already talked about, you know, considerations to get a multifamily like that, you know, sewer system, water, collectors, city roads, are they up to that, you know, increased traffic? There's a whole multitude of things that, you know, come into play there, but kind of working backwards with some examples might answer some of those questions too.
Yeah, right.
There is a perfect example. OC just built that fourplex right downtown where it is really crowded and everything. Right. Has it been an issue? I mean, I hardly see any traffic down there. And I look right down on that road all the time.
I think there was a couple different. There's the OC fourplex, and there was also another.
Maryland did one too.
Yeah, well, Maryland's, and then there was another one across the street from Bowling Green from the roller rink.
That was Maryland's.
Oh, that was Maryland's. Okay.
As far as I've ever, I mean, when I look down there, I don't see a lot of traffic. I don't see a lot of issues with fourplexes down there, and that's really tight down there. So it seems to. You know, they made it so that they had parking, and it seems to, there's not a lot of traffic going downtown through that residential area either. So, and those are only fourplexes.
Yeah, that's a great example that really gets to the where component of this as well. So, talking about low and medium and medium high designations, this is kind of our opportunity to make a recommendation where if someone does maybe want to redevelop their property to something else or look to add more units, the intent of the land use plan would be to give them direction on how much development maybe want to see on that piece of property. So the question kind of becomes, where do we want to see maybe more of that medium high residential development? You know, are we looking at focusing on areas that are already developed? Is it areas that are currently kind of underutilized where it's like, oh, that, you know, maybe there's an abandoned home or something that's being used as a storage lot? Could, if that property owner chose to make a change in how they're managing their land, or they sell it and there's a new owner wants to do something different, do we want to provide that guidance in this land use plan that says, we think this should be housing and we think it should be more high density housing? And where would we want to put that? I know that this is a hard thing to do without going neighborhood by neighborhood, but that's the concept, and the feedback that you're giving us tonight is already, I think, really helpful in helping Cameron and I kind of take a first go, first pass at developing those land use recommendations. But I'm curious from your all perspective, specifically on that redevelopment potential. Is that something where we want to go through and maybe increase density in any particular neighborhood? Where do you see potential where we could do that? Where might apartments be more helpful? Or should that be consolidated to property that's not developed at the moment?
I mean, that might be a good question. I know this forum tonight and other forums that we've had in the past have been good opportunities for property owners to come and kind of express their interest in what they want to do and try to create a mechanism to do it. But obviously we haven't seen a whole lot of turnout in that, at least not tonight necessarily. I mean, it might be worth, we know who owns the property that can be developed. I mean, we know that Co-Widdon's property at the end of the valley is owned by Glennell's, the ones that have the hydrants and the road system that's already there. And it might be worth making a phone call and saying, hey, what's the barrier to construction? And that might be able to, we might be able to bridge that. It's an idea. We're a small community, so it's not hard reaching out. I mean, most of the land's owned by OC. You know, OC is not going to sell it. They're going to lease it. So you can kind of take that off the table. And then using the city's tools that are already at their disposal, you can see what open land is actually available. It's not a rock cliff, or it's flat land that can be developed.
Cameron, do you feel like you got enough helpful direction on this for us to continue with our land use allocation exercise?
I think my one other question with this would be going back to redevelopment. So building up areas that are already have housing on them, should we encourage those like particular areas of town that are already built up to have higher density?
So do you have an example of something?
seems like the exactly to get rid of the fourplex, right? It was the, it's where the courthouse used to be.
Yeah.
And now there's monuments there. Or the trans house on Staten Island where it was World War II duplex, and they converted it to a triplex.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Something that's already built. Yeah.
Yep.
To be able to remodel it to something bigger. I think that that's a great idea. I mean, again, less regulation and better, you know, what works and what's affordable for people to do. You know, the affordability is, you know, there's certain things that make things cheaper, you know, one foundation, one roof.
Well, it's potentially a lot more affordable to add another room onto an existing duplex than it would be to build an entirely new triplex.
Right. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that does. Yeah, Tara, I mean, I think we're good to move on if you feel like you answered everything on your end.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was a great discussion. Switching gears quite a bit. Actually, maybe before we jump into tourism, let's talk about considering infrastructure expansion. So it sounds like, yes, we are interested in encouraging what can traditionally be called infill development. So looking at expanding and adding more density to areas that are already developed. If we're talking about new areas or where we're going to want to encourage development, you know, just keeping in mind that that all comes with infrastructure costs, as we were talking about before, you know, if people want to develop something new and they need utilities out there, they have to run the cost. They are incurring the cost of running utilities out there or making road improvements to meet their particular needs. How much of a barrier has that been to development overall in your community, specifically infrastructure costs? So whether that's commercial, residential, processors, how much is the infrastructure the limiting factor?
We had this discussion when we were talking about utilities.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Eric can even elaborate a little bit about it, but we were talking about that. And when somebody wants to develop, but if some, you know, is who pays for the extension of the utilities to get out there to the property?
How far do they have to go?
Yeah, how far is it going? You know, if we had talked about, well, what if somebody wants to put something up over on Overland Drive? Is the city going to pay to run utilities all the way up there with the, you know, the person building up there? Would they have to?
I think right now it's the person building.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a break there.
There's an opportunity, I guess, where if there is a cost share and there's that benefit to the city for expanding the services or any new development or main extension, primary extension would be brought to council. So a formal agreement can be created if it's possible for both parties to share that cost. There's that option.
But that's not codified right now, is it?
No, it's a policy.
I think there's an avenue to help for the city to help.
That's a big burden on the project though. On the project.
Yeah.
You got to spend a lot of money to bring, especially if it's a project up.
Just preparing the land to build is just by the time you flatten it out, dig a hole, put concrete in there for a foundation or whatever you're going to do for foundation, put your get your sewer and your water there, and your electricity. That's, I mean, you haven't even started the building yet.
Right.
You know, that's huge. And I don't know if there's anything that can, you know, help with that. But
well, you think about it too, where the city has developed the land, like on Skeeble, there are no utilities going up Skeeble.
That's a perfect place to build up there, but it's such deep down. But that I remember when they used to have everybody lived up there in the cabanas.
Oh, it was a good time back then.
Yeah.
Nostalgic.
Great. We're becoming old timers.
That's what I'm thinking.
So there is an avenue for potentially receiving some support from the city to incur those costs. I guess I'll just leave the infrastructure expansion conversation as something to keep in mind, that that might be a tool for the toolbox later on, to consider maybe looking at that opportunity a little bit closer, seeing if there's interest in expanding that, if there are certain types of development that you really want to see that you as a city have prioritized and said that this is something we want to support beyond the application process that currently exists. So thinking about that as a potential tool or minds to consider. Switching gears, we heard a lot about tourism back in February. We had a focus group that was not solely focused on tourism, but ended up becoming a largely tourism conversation and just economic development in general around the opportunity of tourism and growing that. And I am very curious about your perspectives on it. How do we feel about it in general? How much do we want to place an emphasis on growing investments or making investments into the tourism potential of Unalaska? And thinking about it, not just in terms of like bringing people to appreciate the wonderful community that you have, but also just economic diversity. We think about people coming in always being tourists, but I know that it's been in the discussions for a long time about potential increased military presence. And if you're bringing people of any type for any reason into your community, what types of services do they need? What are they looking for? And what's going to keep them here? All pretty broad questions. So maybe we'll start with kind of tourism. How do we feel? What's your gut reaction if we say we want to expand tourism?
To expand tourism, to build a dock. You know, they got to be able to tie up anytime they please when they come to town.
Well, to build on that too, it needs to, like, right now the city dock is great, but it's also away from anything the tourists really want to see for the most part. They have to hike and truck down the road and so on, and okay, there's no sidewalks and stuff like that. So it's like there may be some missing links. Not too long ago, it seems like there was talk about possibly putting in a dock over by Agnes Beach, like a cruise ship dock over by Agnes Beach. I think the pilots actually said that would be a feasible place to do it, a little more centrally located and stuff like that. And with the cruise ships, like a dock like that, you would like Ketchikan or somewhere else, the cruise ship companies oftentimes will pony up quite a bit of money to help build the infrastructure to create a facility like that. I mean, I would fully support tourism. I think cruise tourism is the most obvious right now. Years ago, back in the 90s, we used to have quite a bit of bird watchers coming out here, along with people doing charter fishing. The Grand Aleutian took a very active role in tourism and getting people to stay at the Grand Aleutian. We've seen that taper away quite a few years ago. I think it's a real positive thing. I mean, it definitely is not a bad thing, but making sure we encourage the infrastructure that the tourists want to see, I think, is also going to be a critical component to that.
Don't forget to work on the airfare to be able to bring more people, you know, besides the cruise ship. They're going to do by rule. Yeah, that's the biggest.
Yeah.
That's the biggest concern is getting in here and getting out. You know, it's bad enough when you're stranded, but if you got to pay a lot to get in here, and if you get stranded and pay a lot to stay in the hotel, it's really going to drop down those people that want to come in. It's losing interest.
You know, I think one thing that's not on here as well, and I realize that the question was very tourism focused, but I think supporting our current industry as well. I mean, I think it's critical that we look for more military presence, like we've talked about for many, many years. Tourism, I think, is something we can really tap into and have some positive outcome with. But one thing that's very important to me is that we don't forego supporting our current industry. And that's through setting policy at our different meetings, through the comprehensive plan that we're talking about now, is really ensuring that in what we're doing, we're supporting our current industry as well.
Yeah, a theme that came out of the tourism and economic diversity discussion was really that investments made for tourists need to also be good for our community. They should be dual purpose. And I think that was a really, really strong theme, right? Is that if we're going to make an investment in the name of tourism, it should also have a direct benefit to the people who are living and working here. So I think that's definitely compatible.
Yeah.
One thing that I've heard a lot about with, and this affects the community and tourism, is the road, or so we have a sidewalk path, walking path or whatever, but it kind of stops at the S-curves. And, you know, even though you can cross the road and walk along the beach, and then you cross back over when you get over by the post office, right? And people coming in, they don't know that that's there. And so they end up in the road, or they're on the other side of the, there's some sort of crosswalks or sidewalks, or so people know where that is, you know, and then maybe complete the paving of that road, of that, because it's not paved along there either, along the beach. It's a great place because you're by the water. You can see whales and wildlife and stuff, but people don't know to go over there, and it becomes more of a bigger issue. And then even all the way from the airport, there's nowhere for them to walk until they get to the Grand, I believe, right? And then again, across the road. But so somehow expanding sidewalks or walking path there, I think that would be an inexpensive investment, but that would help as well.
Yeah.
And it helps traffic because a lot of times, especially that area over by Safeway and the Grand Aleutian, they're all walking in the street,
yeah.
You know, so when they're all in town, they had a place to walk.
When we did the repaving right around 2010, we actually talked about putting in sidewalks. One of the questions that came up were sidewalks on the S-curves in particular. And I remember Chris mentioning that there were certain setbacks and there were issues with sidewalks on the S-curves on the water side because the water was too, the cliff where the water was too close. And then on the land side,
yeah.
the mountains or yeah. the hills were too close and it required blasting and potentially eminent domain and stuff like that.
Oh, so that was actually an issue there.
Yeah.
You couldn't pave it.
Specifically on the S-curves, yeah.
Well,
sounds like an engineering issue.
Yeah, there's some big erosion. So,
yeah.
And once you develop that, you might as well put a guardrail in there because you don't want anybody going over the side because it's pretty steep. With erosion. Yeah, but that's erosion really digging down in there. But that's a good spot for them to walk in the sites.
It's yearly. Going to be a yearly cost to maintain and repair the erosion on the S-curves. I mean, unless you put in big, huge rocks in there to break it up and build over that.
It's still
not going to mm-hmm. stop it. But we throw down rocks and like pebbles to the ocean when it does for a storm on the northwest. Wash it off.
Maybe it's as simple as a crosswalk.
Seawall.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a crosswalk. You don't yeah. just... You know, to guide people one side of the road to the other. That's another.
Actually, one of those lit crosswalks with the lights where they can hit the button and notice the difference.
I can do it.
Blind spot.
Truck drivers are not going to stop. Anyway, that's something to look at.
Yeah, that's
I agree. Yeah. It's a hazard for them to walk that road.
I think diversity, you know, diversifying is good to keep your eye out there, mm-hmm. you know, because you just never know what's going to happen. And so I think, you know, having some sort of tourist and, you know, plan, but I think we do need to concentrate on what we have. But yeah, a lot of times the tourism, it gets, you know, it's the dock space, right? If we're full with cargo ships and fishing boats offloading, and then there's no place for them. And so, and I think we've seen a downturn this year in cruise ships earlier in the year. And I think a lot of that might have to do with They get bumped off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they think they have a place, and then all of a sudden a fishing boat says, oh, I'm coming in, and then they get kicked off.
You guys run into that stuff? No. Not the ship. You guys turn away any cruise ship?
No.
So I think like
I think there's two less than we had last year. And that was because
I recall like back when I was on the Visitors Bureau, like it was very fluid. There wasn't like we're not saying two. We didn't have like 20 each year.
Right.
There was surges and they're down a couple each year and the more that would come and all that kind of stuff.
And again, getting that position three connected in there, it's really it helps a lot with that. Yeah, expanding it all the way.
Yeah. I mean, I think really that those core values or whatever that first page is that I pontificated on, I think that's going to be really the most critical component of this, because really if we start doing the development and creating the policy that we're talking about tonight, I mean, and say something as simple as allowing a duplex to have somebody staying on one side and then a small shop on the other, we're going to be providing what the tourism economy needs, and that's that nuance of our community. You know, I say a shop that sells a Snickers bar, it could be a shop that sells something more local, Sandberg jam, something along those lines, you know.
Guns and ammo.
Guns and ammo. You know? Calls Carl's. Can I elaborate?
I think where the significant impact would be is we're unable to confirm the vessels. So they do get what we call as a tentative confirmation. So we're going to put you in place, you know, unless we have a commercial entity that will displace you. So we try to ride that out. Well, the cruise ships, of course, want guarantees. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that a lot of the time. So we may not even know. The part that we don't know about is that some of those cruise ships may not even just schedule because of those reasons. So we never even see them before they're able to cancel. So in the sense of, you know, if we were able to have some, like, say, dedicated dock space for that mm-hmm. type of tourism, we would be able to confirm those vessels and potentially, if that's something the community wanted and we agreed to, would increase could potentially increase the amount of cruise ships we get every year, because now they can sell their tickets guarantee to their people mm-hmm. that we have this. But another piece of that is also making sure our airport and airlines and those situations can also accommodate that cruise to really make it a really robust type of our tourism that we were really trying to target. So those are the considerations that kind of maybe keep it at that 20 ships a year, mm-hmm. 19, 18 ships a year.
The cruise ship terminal could look vastly different than what the city dock looks like right now. You know, a cruise ship terminal in large part is dolphins with a floating pier. I mean, if you look at like Ketchikan or Juneau, I mean, they have different types there, obviously, but I think if that is the path we go down, we could develop it without it costing $50 million or $70 million in cost.
OC could build one at the Spit and we could have public transportation.
Well, the cruise ship really to help, you know, carry the load and spend money, put some investment into it.
But I mean, it's also location too, right? Like, if we, I know you're probably fractionally joking, but like, say if we did put a cruise ship out of the light cargo dock right now, that's probably the last place in town that they would want to be.
Unless we have buses. Lots of buses.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a real public transportation.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like Ketchikan, you know, they have buses that go back and forth to take all those tourists, you know, through town and to all the little places.
Yeah.
So that would go with the public transportation.
But I guess the reason I just bring that up is I don't think we should be fixated on expanding City Dock necessarily, as opposed to finding an appropriate location for that specific type of dock. I was saying maybe City Dock is the right way to go, expanding that and using it as multi-use just like it is now, but I think we should just keep our options open and figure out what's best.
I'm hearing interest and continue to explore and potentially make investments to growth, right? Is that fair? Okay.
Yeah, they're looking at the South America in there. That I think that's the one place that they look at, and it might look really good in there.
It's deep.
Yeah. Before you reach Carl Moon, if you want to. No.
I know. So you should just build it. Build it and they will come.
What I've been saying for 20 years. Cost to build something out here and get the materials by the time you get it here is 10 times the cost of.
But you guys plan. Own all the rot too.
It so takes 5 years to get a good plan.
And you can use it on boats when it's off season with a cruise ship.
Day of the last year.
Yeah. There used to be a floating bunkhouse down there right by the bridge. Remember that?
Mm.
Remember the floating bunkhouse there that was by the bridge? Basically between Carl Moses and the bridge.
The Magellan.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. Magellan, so, is it? By Pan-Alaska.
Well, that was a blue one, yeah.
Yeah, the Magellan.
Magellan. But there was another one, silver.
Code enforcement. This was there not too long ago.
And we're kind of jumping back a little bit. We kind of touched on a code enforcement question. This is something that Cameron was specifically curious about from your perspective. I know we're talking about just kind of a trend in the ability to be more flexible with your property and what you do with it. Overall, is there a change in how the city is approaching enforcement that you'd like to see? Should there generally be more of it or less of it? Is it a problem?
I think it's inappropriate right now. I haven't seen an issue with code enforcement. I think at one of our council meetings recently, somebody suggested creating a code enforcement position, which by no means do I think that's appropriate. In fact, just the opposite. I think that.
Enforcement.
I'm sorry?
What was that enforcement?
Code enforcement.
Yeah, code enforcement. I think it's just fine the way it is right now. I haven't heard any complaints either about it, which is really appropriate.
Since Cameron, are you sure the background why you're asking this question?
Sure. This is a question we've kind of wrestled with a lot. As you might already know, our code enforcement is complaint driven here. I don't go out looking at people's properties to find code violations myself. If I did, I think every property on my way home would probably have something. We wait for a complaint, which does mean that we don't do a lot of code enforcement, and it's pretty. That has gotten to be a little inconsistently applied at times. Someone's neighbor might be crabby at them, so they're going to complain. Somebody might have a similar property, but they're not going to complain. So there's that. There's also, we struggle with just how hard it is to clean things up here. So a lot of the nuisance complaints we get are about junk, abandoned vehicles, stuff on your residential lot. But we recognize, you know, when we do get those complaints, that it is really hard to get rid of that stuff here. So we don't want to necessarily be overly punitive with people, but we also are trying to recognize that, like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be using this property as, you know, a junkyard storage, basically. And I'm just trying to understand better where the council's thoughts are and where we should be landing on that balance going forward.
And I guess I feel less regulation,
yeah,
you know, and you know, if it's a problem, less we need to address it.
I mean, it's pretty tough to come forward to, especially if it's a business, and tell them they can't do anything with their own property, then start.
Zoning issue, not ownership.
Well, some people, you know, it's expensive to buy stuff and get it here. Some people hold on to stuff for parts, and that used to be the mentality, you know, way back when. I mean, everybody went to the dump to get parts. That was your parts store. Or they had the same vehicle. They had multiple vehicles of the same one so that they could fix the one they're driving. And a lot of people still feel that way. You know, they, I'll tell you, my husband is one of them. He'll go to the dump and bring more back than he took.
I don't see this problem with the way it's being done right now. And really the methodology you use and your approach, the fact that somebody hasn't claimed, at least to me, that says a lot that you're doing what you need to do and it's being done appropriately. So I'm pretty happy with the way it is now. And I'm right with Deneen and Bong and the mayor. Like, I think appropriate enforcement is appropriate, but I don't think it needs to change from where we're at now.
I guess if you get a complaint, I would follow through with that.
Yeah. Here's what they're doing, yeah.
Yeah.
Any code enforcement stuff or actions that have been taken that you are aware of? I guess the limited that I've seen have been where the violation was way outside of the norm. I think that kind of falls where any enforcement actions that have been taken could be classified as. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say that's generally fair. I mean, there is, like with the complaint-driven process we have now, it's not necessarily consistently applied, right? Because there might be a property that's way far out of the norm, but we're not receiving complaints about it, so we don't do anything about it. But yeah, it's generally more extreme examples that we get complaints about.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that, justifies the, going down that road. I'm not, a code enforcement person. That's another full-time employee, and that gets into a whole other discussion about budgets and, that type of stuff. And I think we're quite there yet on that discussion.
Yeah. Everybody agrees you guys are doing a good job.
Yeah.
Certainly, if the city has a code for residential properties, they need to enforce it at some point. See more and more collectors, put it that way, gouging parts off vehicles, and then they leave their mess and bring in another. I don't know. Pretty soon, there's too many. I know. It's a health issue. It's a safety issue. I'm at the point where I've talked to people who are next door to me and asked them to first do that. Vehicles off my property. I'm going to keep it different a day or two. I'm waiting for my friend to haul it away. So, okay, so I have another day or two. I think other people other than myself have that problem. And they're not, they don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. I told them. But yeah, they point to Cameron, but they don't. So that's the way to go about it. Some of them asked me, and I said, well, you go to Cameron, or you go to the police station or the fire department, say there's a safety issue regarding parking. Can't even see the fire hydrant. Vehicles parked on top of the building. And I don't know. There has to be some kind of maybe a campaign from the city to put up some notices.
Like an education campaign.
An education type thing, and it tells them maybe they didn't know. They haven't been told. The guys are trying to do their best to clean it up and clean out, but about 2 weeks later, back full again.
I guess there's a couple different factors or different scenarios, I guess, we're talking about there too. Here is one as far as code enforcement would be like having 10 dwellings in a someone's renting out multiple rooms in a, you know, in a fourplex, you know, where we've got too many people and you got fire code violations and all that type of stuff. I could see where we go back to the drive program here that we were had done earlier, where we try and make it easier to get rid of these junk vehicles, get rid of this, you know, construction debris, those type of things. That a lot of times, you know, vehicles, when you look, just focus on vehicles, it's, yeah, you can, you pay, you know, as part of your registration as a disposal fee, right? But it's still difficult to get rid of that vehicle. I can't take the tires off and then drag it down to the dump, landfill, and get rid of it. Or, you know, it's have the ability to drain all the fluids and all that type of stuff. So
it's a costly venture to clear out your, you know, the fluid out and do all that stuff, especially if people are working full time to pay to have it done and pay another individual. About $500 per vehicle right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they took advantage of it in some cases when we had the barge here. I mean, some people were paying $700-$800.
Maybe that's a city service.
And if you really want it out of your yard, you'll pay.
Construction debris would be another one, right? You know, if you're going to remodel, you know, part of your house and you've got $5,000 worth of debris that needs to go to the dump. I'm just throwing a number out there, but,
yeah,
you know, it discourages people from, you know, properly disposing of that, right? But that stuff, right? Yeah. And it becomes a deterrent to maintaining or cleaning up your yard or, you know, it's encouraging people to dig a hole and put it in there, right?
Right.
Well, the abandoned buildings downtown, yeah, that, you know, and I know that we've agreed to waive those fees, but why don't we waive them for everybody? You know, why, if we're going to burn the wood, why do we charge people to burn their wood for them?
Do we charge?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to charge people to burn wood.
Director.
those pallets, man, cost a lot.
I know. I mean, I get to burn a lot of people's pallets in our little pit, but because they would rather bring them to me then take them to the dump. Because
I did that.
Yeah, well, I know. Well, but it doesn't make sense to pay to burn wood. I mean, I see, I know we have the, what is it, the, I can't think of the grain, whatever the, what do you call it? Why am I forgetting the name of it? What? I mean, we have to pay maintenance on the
Baler.
The baler, yeah.
Well, they're gonna use baler.
I mean, we have to, and we have to pay people I know, but those people are getting paid whether we take that wood there or not, because they still have to be there for the baler. And why does anybody have to be there except for when they're burning? I'm sure they have to monitor, maintain it, but does someone sit there all the time that we're paying to do that? I don't know.
A lot of the debris is not necessarily always wood. It's sheetrock, it's vinyl, the tile,
asbestos.
Well, that stuff, yeah. But wood.
Insulation, all that type of stuff.
But they separate that when they dump it, though. Mm-hmm. That's separated when they dump it. That wood.
They have to separate it, yes, when they take it out.
And then there's construction debris like that, no.
No?
I apologize. I stepped out a little bit just so I'm clear on where we're at right now. We're talking about setting reasonable policies to support the community and getting rid of the debris that's on their property.
That's something that council can do,
yeah,
or has some latitude and in setting, you know, fees and look at the fees and schedules. So,
which that's
nibbles away at, you know, the housing issues and some of these other things.
But I think when it comes to the comprehensive plan, I mean, we're talking about basically policy decisions throughout the entire plan. I think setting reasonable policies to promote people disposing of the junk that's on their land is definitely part of this. It squarely falls under code enforcement.
But like you got to differentiate between residential, commercial, and industrial, though.
Sure. Just like you know.
Yeah, but
if I bring a bag of garbage to the landfill, I don't pay anything.
But industrial, they bring trucks and trucks of pallets. If you don't charge those, man, that's quite a load on the city's time and their equipment.
Some kind of education program would really help before we go into enforcement or violations. So there should be time for them to figure out, oh, Maybe I didn't know. I mean, I had to see people get in violation or something they didn't understand, or were told differently by somebody else that it's okay. So I don't know if it's an issue. Not only the residential people, it's the commercial entities in this town need to be educated about burn piles, where they can and can't burn, burn half the island down in some cases, or leave it abandoned once they started. This happened on South America, so people dump their pallets or whatever, set fire to them and drive off.
Yeah, that's not good.
Half hour or 40 minutes later, you see smoke really coming out of there.
And when you get windy, yeah, it burns a lot of thunder.
It's an education program we get put into play. Then I would enforce it after they continue.
Are you supportive of our guidance on
code? Yeah, this has actually been a really helpful conversation for me. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Not just for this discussion, but for all of it so far on the land use designations, on housing density, this has all been really helpful. I do want to be mindful of our time that we were scheduled to go until 8:30, which is 4 minutes from now. We nailed this pretty much on the head with timing, but I do want to just kind of pose some open-ended questions. This is the comprehensive plan. This is our 10 to 15 year vision for the future. I'm curious if there are any particular long-term efforts or community priorities that you just want to take this opportunity to state and make sure that, you know, Cameron and I are aware of. I know he's been doing an excellent job keeping me in the loop on, you know, what is maybe a hot topic of discussion at council meetings as of late, but are there any long-term priorities that you would like to speak to and make sure that we are adequately addressing in this plan?
Airport.
Number one.
That seems to be the problem. Everything we have, that airport seems to kind of hinder.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the exact same thing when he was making some comments about housing and all that, and tourism. Yeah, all that rolls back around into that discussion about air travel. And,
for clarity, when we're talking about air travel, we're not just talking about extending the runway or filling in the Hog Island or whatever.
I mean, air service.
We're talking about, air service as a whole. That's the cost of flights. That's flights actually coming in when they're scheduled. That's policies around air travel in Unalaska. But by no means do we mean air travel equals extending the runway. We mean as a whole, in a holistic approach, like how this community approaches air travel needs to be addressed.
That's on the runway. We get a lot more activity. We need a large facility to keep people in while they wait to leave.
Operating out of a terminal that really was renovated in 2007 or so, but the renovation was to slap a corn orange paint on it, or red paint, whatever it is. Red or
but if we don't have any airplanes coming and going, do you need to spend the money on a terminal?
Fair enough.
Right? Maybe we need to build a runway over the town that's long enough. That
Peace.
All right.
There's all kinds of ideas that money's no object. So
I know, right?
If Senators come tomorrow.
We got $500 million. I think we can do a lot. Somehow
we need to get them. They need to get stuck here. But being on a C-130, that's hard to do.
So what are the long-term efforts or community priorities? Discussed them all already.
Did you guys get what you needed from us?
I feel like, Karen, is there anywhere that you still have questions? I feel like I've gotten a lot of great threads to start pulling on with some of these topics.
Yeah, no, I thought this has been really robust discussion. Really appreciate everyone's time and consideration. And it seems like you did a little bit of homework, came prepared to dive into this, which we appreciate. By no means is this the last time. I hope you don't feel like this is your opportunity to say your two cents on the comp plan and we're done. We will be working on a draft plan, and that draft will be put out for public review. And part of that, you're absolutely welcome to, and we'll be encouraged to provide feedback at that time as well. So if you have ideas in the meantime, don't be shy to send them to Cameron or myself directly. Yeah, excited to keep going. And I just want to thank you all for an opportunity for inviting me to be a part of your community through this process. I'm sure you hear it all the time. Unalaska is a very unique and special place, and it is truly an honor and a privilege to be able to be part of your community in this process. So thank you.
You know, one thing.
Thank you for your work in that place. We have a lot to do.
Late in the game, but the transportation component that we talked about right off the get-go, is that going to be part of the comp plan?
Yes. So we're still talking about exactly how that's going to be incorporated into the comprehensive plan. We've done this study that, you know, really objectively looks at like how a transit system could work here. I think how we prioritize that with everything else and fit it together with the rest of the plan, still figuring out.
Yeah.
But if you're curious, that's ready. We can share it with you.
Cool. The reason I ask is I'm kind of concerned about going down that rabbit hole again, in that what I heard tonight really kind of mimics the taxis we have here. I mean, it parallels it pretty much exactly. And then the like pickup points and drop off points, we tried that already, I don't know, in 2012 or 13 or something like that. With the 15 passenger van the PCR has right now, the city under Bill Hompton, when he was planning director, tried establishing routes and did it for a decent amount of time, 6 months, a year, something like that, and that failed. So the fact we're having the same discussion again, to try to rebuild something that's already failed once, and then we've established, we've already got in place, I don't know if that is a direction I'm comfortable going down. But again, I'm stepping into this very late in the game, so there's more to it, I'm sure.
So you just want to clarify, I don't know about 2012 or so, when we ran a bus system, we were doing a study in 2017, 2018 to evaluate this. And that was more of a fixed route system, so kind of what you're familiar with in other communities where it has fixed drop-off points. So that was intended to assess whether, you know, this is feasible at all. My predecessors presented that to council, and the direction following that was, you know, to do a deeper study with an outside firm of transit specialists, and that's why we decided to incorporate into this plan update. It just seemed like a good time to do that.
Yeah, if you could email that to me.
Yeah, totally. Check it out. Yeah.
Well, the one problem with transit is then it cuts into taxis, right? But you have a problem getting a taxi at nighttime. They just don't, they want to all be in bed sleeping like anybody would. It really becomes an issue with longshoremen that need to take a taxi because their job starts at 1 a.m. Employees that work late at night at a bar can't get home at night because, you know, so it's like, oh, we can't keep the kitchen open to feed these people because they can't get a taxi to go home. After work, they can't get people so that they don't drive intoxicated. You know, there's lots of issues at nighttime where I think some sort of transit system would help a lot.
So I guess the question I have then, do we have a government subsidized system or a government system? Or do we create a system that promotes Uber and Lyft and effectively privatize that point to point?
The dial-a-ride, you still pay anyone on a public transit system.
Yeah.
You know, is it subsidized?
I mean, like,
I don't necessarily that the cost is the issue. It's the availability.
For the end user, but for us, it would definitely be the cost.
Oh, no, I mean, yeah. I mean, like, for the end user. So what I'm saying is the government could have it so that the reliability is there, but it could be paid by the end user as a service.
It'd be hard to do. I think the reason there's government mass transit right now is because it's subsidized mass transit, not like for us to actually make money on.
Oh, but I wouldn't say
it would be heavily subsidized. If we just passed a code that said Uber and Lyft, you're good to go, oversimplifying it, I realize that. And there is downside to that because that would compete with the taxis. I think that could potentially solve our
sending to our sitting at home. The other thing I thought about is the visitor bureau and the school has these vehicles. That would be a way for them to make some money on some kind of agreement with the city of what that is. I mean, so much per vehicle, that's it. Top of the line, pay for fuel and oil change, whatever. Insurance and all that would be on the owner. I mean, at least they'd make some money.
They could earn some money with that.
Rather than trying to invent a wheel or invite somebody to buy a $40,000 vehicle. You only use it 2 times a year.
I think
that's what's happening now with the school and with the visitor bureau.
They share them.
Yeah, I know they share them, but still it's a cost issue. They share them just out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. We could use their system versus going in the city and, and trying to get transportation.
I mean, we can authorize Uber and Lyft for 2 meetings.
I think there's some big downsides to where we're going as far as using city, vehicles like that. But it might be good to, if we're going to go down this conversation more, is to maybe to dust off that old study. Because you touched on a lot of these topics that we just spoke about. So
yeah, I'll send that out to everybody because that was a practical demonstration of what a system could look like. That was specifically a fixed route system with buses. But then this transit study is looking at a broader array of models. There's a lot of different setups that are used in other rural parts of Alaska or the lower 48. They've all got pros and cons, but it goes into what those, how those might work in Alaska if they would. And then a lot of analysis of the capital and operating costs of those. I think it'd be helpful.
Yeah, another thing on public transit, it wouldn't necessarily be public transit, but opening up taxi permits. Why are we limited to how many taxi permits you can have?
I think it's so that we buy this off. Because the more permits, the less people are made. But then if we get Uber and Lyft, it would pretty much run the taxis out of business potentially. So that's the downside of that.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying if they, maybe if they had to work more, because they needed more money, they would be on 24 hours instead of.
Or if we created.
We got more licenses that are not being used right now. I think there's enough in there that are issued, and I don't think they're all being used.
The other thing, too, is if somebody has a taxi permit, they have a certain obligation to drive. And if all of the taxis stop driving at 2 a.m., between 2 a.m. and 10 a.m., I mean, is that obligation being 10
p.m. to
right?
Yeah, 10 or 11.
This was cool. This is a good meeting. Thank you.
But this was really helpful for us. So thank you. I know it's a lot. I've already got another council meeting this week. So thank you.
That's all right. We tend to get off on 10.
Okay. All right. Are we done?
Yeah.
I think
we're
now.
Yeah, ready to wrap up.
Make a motion to get out of work session.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Tungle, second by Councilman Sashdin to go back to regular session. Are there any objections? Hearing no objection, we're back in regular session at 8:38.
We're
in regular session now. Community input. This time for members of the public to provide information to the council, make announcements of interest to the community. Anyone?
Nobody.
Zoom. problem or otherwise.
But we have one committee report, Mayor.
For the clerk, or we have written comments submitted, or does anyone wish to speak on phone?
No, sir.
Well, good. Thank you. Council directives to the manager. Are there any directives? Need a motion, a second, and a vote. Okay. Having completed all items on the agenda, we're adjourned at 8:40.
Thank you for me.
Yeah, 8:39.
Yeah, thank you.